make your own radio, on air and online. Complete the form on planetaudio.org.nz.
Tired?
Mercy Spirituality Centre presents Muffin Talk with Beate.
Kia ora and welcome to our Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Centre in Epsom. We are a centre for retreats, spiritual guidance, Christian meditation and personal development. Once a week, I invite a visitor to join me in the studio to talk about our centre, our programs, social justice or different cultures. Today, my visitor is Brother Chris Popplewell. Brother Chris, a warm welcome and hi to my radio program.
Thank you.
Brother Chris is a Maoist brother and he is originally from Bluff, the South Island of New Zealand. He has worked many years as a missionary in the Pacific and in East Timor. Maoist brothers work in a variety of ministries, from teaching to mentoring, youth ministries and prison chaplaincies. These feed into the education and formation of young people, especially the poor and the marginalized. Brother Chris, you worked as a missionary in many countries. What field did you work in?
Basically, the field that I was working in was education. A lot of it was being school principal and then occasionally being, say, director of Catholic school system. But inevitably, in countries with small populations like these, you end up doing a great deal of counselling. You, of course, have to do much of your own maintenance work around the place. You can also follow up some of your own interests. I developed an interest in weather forecasting, also in local medicine, just as things that people were needing, and it was a possible way in which you could be of benefit to people.
Local medicine, so is it something like, did you look at the herbs that people were using to cure some diseases?
Some of that, but because I realized that I would not be all that long in one particular country or would eventually be returning to New Zealand, I took much more interest in massage work in particular, and so physical healing like that was important.
So are you going to practice it in New Zealand too?
I have been doing so everywhere where I've been, but it depends on where the opportunity is. It usually remains as a small sideline.
And you worked in different countries in the Pacific, quite a few. Did you see any common threads in your work in the Pacific Islands?
Well, I think that is so, although a lot of it is the influence of metropolitan countries like New Zealand. For example, there is the desire to improve children's situation. And most people see that as, well, they need to get education, better education than their parents have had, for example. But then the other part of it is, of course, to get good jobs. This will give the children a better situation, but at the same time, of course, it would help the parents in their old age, quite possibly. Another thing is a great desire to live and work overseas, because seeing those who come back from a country like New Zealand or visiting and seeing the people who live here in New Zealand see that, well, they are living well, they're living at a much higher standard than can be possible at home, and so there is that attraction to migrate and to work overseas. That's going to give you better living. You expect that to happen. Better income, better food, better health. It doesn't always work that way, of course. Unfortunately, the desire to travel, once a person is living in another country, they so often find that they have overlooked the disadvantages. And so the island people in New Zealand have got very different problems from those at home, but they're still very serious problems.
Have you met any who went back to their island?
Oh, many. And it's something that I encourage, that if you go overseas to work, then you should set yourself up, be able to bring back enough money and knowledge to benefit your own country. And so the ideal, perhaps, of going when you're fairly young and doing study and working, and then coming back, middle-aged perhaps, and being able to set up something in your own country, you can be of real benefit, far more benefit than foreign people coming in to tell you what to do. I often feel embarrassed about that.
But as you say, you are encouraging people when they leave and then they might come back, and so that they don't lose face when they're coming back.
Yes, that's so. When I first went overseas, Tonga was the first country I went to, I found there that those who came back were rather resented. They were seen as not being real Tongans at all, and perhaps Wendt's book, wasn't it, Sons of the Return Home, illustrates it very well, that when they come back, they're just not listened to. The old structures are there, and these people aren't part of it. They think differently, and therefore they tend to be ignored. And so it's rather discouraging. But I have found in more recent years that people are more accepting of those who've lived overseas, particularly if they're in a position to set up some structure that will help local people.
Yeah, once you're successful, then it's all easier.
It is easier.
For those of you who've just tuned in, you're listening to Muffin Talk with Beate. This program is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Epsom. If you miss any of our programs, please check out www.planetofaudio.org.nz/muffintalk or visit our website or Facebook page at Tengaka Waiora Mercy Spirituality Center. My visitor today is Brother Chris Popplewell. Brother Chris, you have told us about your experience in the Pacific. What about your time in East Timor?
Well, that was a particularly difficult time. At the time, the Indonesians had pulled out, but unfortunately there was a scorched earth policy, and so destruction was very great. A lot of killings, destruction of the infrastructure. And so I went to join a group that had gone a couple of years before to look at setting up a teacher's college. And so I became part of that.
Maybe you can say a few words about the history, because I think that not everybody will be familiar with the history of East Timor and where it's located. Can you say just a few words?
Okay, we'll get that one cleared. It's northwest of Australia, only about 1,000 kilometres from Darwin. But it was a Portuguese colony in the eastern half of the island of Timor. The western half was part of Dutch East Indies, which became Indonesia after the Second World War. And then in 1975, the Portuguese Revolution at home meant that the country decided to abandon its colonies. And so East Timor was kind of abandoned, and a local government was set up, but the danger was the US in particular thought that it would have a communist government, and that would be a way of communism spreading from Russia and China through Southeast Asia, and here would be a place much further south, so a great danger. And so the US wasn't keen, and Australia had eyes on the oil that's in between Australia and East Timor. And so by having an independent East Timor, it could easily be bullied into an unfair division of the oil reserves, which of course happened. So that when the Indonesians wanted to invade in 1975 to take the land, then they were, what we wouldn't say encouraged, but they were certainly tolerated by both Australia and the US. So they felt confident to go in and invade. That was 1975. And then, up to about the year 1999, there was severe repression and oppression done in East Timor by Indonesian invaders. And that led to, of course, rebellion and outbreaks of trouble at various times. And so people, very often it was groups in countries like Australia and New Zealand, who spoke out to say, well, the Indonesians are being treated so badly, treating the East Timorese so badly, that there's got to be some solution to this. And it did appear the only possible solution would be independence. And so this came about through the UN 1999. But then the damage that was done as the Indonesians withdrew was very great, and it kind of still dominates the situation there today.
In which year did you go to Indonesia?
I went there at the time of their independence. The UN governed the country for about 3 years and then gave independence 2002. So that's when I went and then stayed for about the next 5 years.
Mm-hmm. And so You said that there was a civil war in the 1970s.
Well, it was more an invasion.
More an invasion.
Yes.
Yeah.
There was resistance to it, but of course the local population had no strength to resist the army. But being a very mountainous country, it was possible for people to hide up in the mountains and keep a resistance movement going.
Yeah, and it's exactly 20 years now since the invasion was over.
Well, from 1970 to now...
I thought it was 1999.
That was when the independence came about because the UN intervened. Mm-hmm. Yes, they've now had 20 years since the Indonesians went away.
Yeah.
And then much of that, since 2002, has been an independent government.
And you see the traces of the Indonesian?
Oh, you see the damage. They still haven't restored so much of what was destroyed. The electric power infrastructure, the bridging, the roads, schools, they haven't yet caught up, I'm afraid.
But you said that they were interested in the land. Why would they destroy the bridges?
Well, that was when they were withdrawing.
Mm, okay.
Yes. While they were doing it, they did a great deal of building. And so the idea was really, I think, that anything that we built should really be destroyed because...
So you said now the peace has been restored in the country. But do you think that the people have overcome hostilities?
I think they've overcome hostility, but the problem is the expectations when they gained independence was that they would be prosperous very quickly, that all the good things they had under the Indonesians would continue, and they wouldn't have the oppression, so it sounded wonderful. But, of course, they haven't had all the good things they had under the Indonesians. The rebuilding hasn't been done. Some goes on, but it's quite slow. And then the political parties that developed within East Timor has meant that they're very divided. There are as many as 19 languages in a country of, well, while I was there, around about 500,000 people. And so small groups have their own language and culture, and there's quite a lot of no mixing. And because of the mountain terrain, it is very difficult to get from one place to another. And one characteristic I noticed, very sadly, was that if you had a severe drought or a storm that destroyed food crops, and they were always pretty close to being a situation of not enough food, then one area would face starvation, but there'd be very little help from anybody else, and there was no structure to let the government give help either, and so it often led to a lot of deaths. I had to live with quite a lot of starvation.
So they haven't built like a network between all the different communities and islands?
Well, gradually. There is basically the one island. There's only a small couple of small enclaves elsewhere, but there's not really that great sense of we're all together. Roading hasn't been built up even as much as the Indonesians just yet, and so communities are pretty isolated.
Do you think that before the at the time of the Portuguese, or even before the Portuguese, that the people were communicating more with each other, or were they always in these small maybe an island or an area where they spoke their language, and that's why they developed so many languages, because they just didn't talk to each other?
I would rather think that would be the case, all right. And when the Portuguese came, they only interested really in trade, and therefore they established a few outposts and then didn't take much interest in the rest of it. But if anybody rebelled against the Portuguese, then what they would do is get a group from one place in the country to attack another group in the country. And as a reward, they could take slaves and pillage just as they wanted to.
So that was an advantage for the Portuguese.
Oh, yes, it suited the Portuguese, but it's left the East Timorese very divided.
Yeah.
And so people in the area where I was working, for example, would have enemies in various other parts because they are the ones who killed their family at various times. And the Indonesians continued the policy.
And they don't have a leader, the East Timorese, because that would be really difficult if you have so many different cultures.
Yes, it's difficult for one to emerge, but we did have a wonderfully gifted leader who was really the Nelson Mandela of East Timor, and that was Xanana Gusmão. And he was a wonderfully charismatic figure, still alive, but while being a wonderful rebel leader, he was something of a disaster as a politician. And so once independence came, he tended to lose some of his support, and so he's not the unifying figure that he once was.
Mm. And as you mentioned, East Timor was a Portuguese colony, and it's mainly Catholic. But the huge neighbor Indonesia is predominantly Muslim. How is the relationship between the different religions in the country?
Well, really, to be honest, I think I'd have to say that East Timor is not really very Catholic. What's happened is when the Indonesians took over to get a register of people, they required registration and holding a identity card, and that had to have a religion on it, and it had to be one of the acceptable religions, and there were only five. They would have been Muslim, Catholic, Protestant, Hindu, and Buddhist. And that's really the same as other parts of Indonesia. And so, of course, East Timorese look at this and Muslim, well, they wouldn't want to be Muslim in the circumstances. This was when the Indonesians had first invaded. Catholics they knew about because Portuguese were Catholics, and some were Catholic, about 5%, 5% probably. Also Protestant, never heard of them. Hindu, well, they were in Bali, another island of Indonesia, fair way away, hardly known. Buddhists, hardly known. So really you're left with Catholic as being the only logical choice. And so the proportion of Catholics went from 5% to 95% in around about 5 years, I think. It might have even been less. But how Catholic are they? It's a superficial thing. Basically, it's animist.
Really?
And then
yeah.
Catholic when had to be, and any time there's political threats, lots of people come to the church. But when things are very quiet, then number of Catholics drops off. So it's a Catholicism, but it has a lot of... there's a need for a great deal of understanding of Catholicism. And that's been a great call for missionaries, people to come in, help them understand that nominally they're Catholic, but in reality they don't know much about it.
And you were in the Catholic school, right?
Yes, I was on the staff of the Teachers' College. And so there we, first time in East Timor, we set up a Teachers' College, and then we're trying to train teachers for primary schools, and that has flourished. Mm-hmm. And so it is now producing something like, well, in the original plan, 50 teachers per year through a three-year course. I think now that they've moved into it being 4 years and they're looking at establishing a secondary division. And so this is going well because it's meeting a need and people really do appreciate it.
So it's through the education that the Catholic school, that the Catholic faith and traditions are now present in the country.
Will become known, put it that way.
Yeah.
In the earlier part, you didn't have very much of that. And but then, as far as the what you were saying there about relationships, I am surprised at how tolerant East Timorese have been. Part of this may be the fact that because of the amount of rape that was committed, particularly by the Indonesian police and the special forces of the army. It was actually a matter of policy because that was a way of populating the country with people who would be loyal to Indonesia. And a number of those, by the time I got there, were, of course, coming through our teachers' college. And they were no different to others, perfectly accepted. We all knew that, yes, their parentage was a result of rape, but that was fine. And then others, like Indonesian administrators, they were not disliked at all. It was the police and the army that gave the problems. And so what's happened is that some decided to stay on, not a great number, but many who had married East Timorese would stay, and they were completely accepted. So there are mosques there, and there's no threat, more threat to mosques in New Zealand than in East Timor, which was rather surprising. But no, the toleration is quite remarkable. But the big difficulty is really the intolerance of people of East Timor for other people of East Timor. And that really led to what I felt was a civil war, kind of with a pause button. And that was from a later part of my time there, from about 2006. There'd be incidents every few weeks where groups would be attacking other groups over some incident that might have happened recently or might have happened a long time ago. I think the United Nations identified 27 different groups that could take part on either side of any incident that happened. So you never knew really who was your friend and who was your enemy. There's less of that now because infrastructure is being built up and policing, especially with help from outside, is building up. But there's a long way to go. You'll have to have generations dying out to deal with the fact that people in my family have been killed by these others, therefore they're my enemies. And that problem is very real. And is actually more often between some East Timorese and others, rather than East Timorese and Indonesians or Christians and Muslims.
So would you consider them as tribal affairs?
The incidents, they'll tend to be, yes. And of course, because the language groups in East Timor are relatively small, then they're probably all mostly related, put it that way.
Yeah.
So yes, it is that. So it definitely isn't a religious battle that goes on. But there are far fewer incidents today than there were back in the time I was there, thank God.
When you were there, because that was before the United Nations. No, that was afterwards.
After, yeah. Yes. It was the first years of independence, yeah. When in particular those in the eastern part of East Timor, felt that they were the ones who kept up the rebellion against the Indonesians, and they regarded the ones in the western part of East Timor as collaborating. And so they were really saying, well, we should be the government because we are the ones who resisted the Indonesians. And there's the start of this conflict. But you could go back to Portuguese time and Indonesian time where these rebellions being put down and the killing and plundering that went on as a result made enemies within the country.
So you had the external factors plus the internal.
It's a difficult country.
Yeah.
And then there is a lot of money available now that there's a fairer deal between Australia and East Timor about the oil. Then there's a lot of money available, but people do not have the skills to spend it.
To spend it wisely.
Yeah, well, the government, you see, people under the Indonesians, there was no high-level government officials. East Timorese had only the lowest-level job, so they didn't have any skills. So, for example, in the first year of independence, I think it was, then there were the plans to build 100 schools, but there was no one to build them. And so the money was there, but they couldn't spend it. And so they built, I think, 5 schools. And that kind of problem, as time goes on and people become more skilled, this will be so. But there is a real need to reconcile people within East Timor with others in East Timor. And that's going to be a very long process.
Do you think that the Catholic Church can help in that process?
Very strongly so, because the Catholic Church has always been the independent one. It was never a collaborator, fortunately. Few individuals may well have been, and that's been a problem of Eastern Europe too. But that's the sort of thing that would happen. But basically the Church was trusted, and it was the Church that provided the leadership.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell by the practices in the Catholic Church in East Timor that they were colonized by the Portuguese?
Oh, yes. The major language of the country officially is Portuguese. And as somebody said to me, look at a map. It's another 10,000 kilometers to find the next Portuguese-speaking country.
In either way.
Yes, the Indonesians had made use of English as their international language. They actually rejected Dutch, used English, and of course we were rather important in the introduction of English. So in the UN time, English developed quite rapidly. But then with independence, Portuguese, the official language, there's a local lingua franca, Tetum, that many people understand, but it's limited as a language. And so they're really being forced back into Portuguese. And the Portuguese is what's used in schools for teaching. So in our teachers' college, we were actually having to use 4 languages day by day. Portuguese, we had to have the teachers learning to teach in Portuguese. Tetum was what they understood, and therefore you were teaching things in Tetum where you could. I was doing much of the science, and there wasn't much language available for that. And economically, there's no language available from Tetum, so they still use Indonesian. And then English was used for the study.
Yeah.
Particularly overseas study to get degrees. So the 4 languages just had to be used all the time. However, times change. By now, there will be a much larger number of Portuguese speakers, and the amount of English will still be going on because it is the language of the countries round about. So there will be plenty of that.
Yeah.
But still, they are rather isolated by the fact that their major language is Portuguese, and that is a problem.
Yeah, but and on the other hand, it's at least a unifying language that doesn't belong to any of the tribes.
Yes, there is that. Tetum is regarded as like that. There's about three of the 19 districts that have a language of Tetum or close to Tetum. There is that. So that's quite accepted, but the difficulty is its limitations. The Sisters of St. Joseph tried to get a development of the language, but that proved a very difficult one. So in its way, Portuguese can only serve as being the most unifying of the languages, and it's not necessarily the best.
Well, you have in Macau, you had Portuguese, and in Goa, you had Portuguese, so they were.
And they've both taken on English now.
Yeah, they are more English now than Portuguese.
Portuguese has gone from there.
Yeah, but it's a beautiful language.
It is, but it's a difficult language. I thought English pronunciation was difficult until I met Portuguese.
That's because you're an English speaker.
Yes, but I didn't have too much trouble in reading Portuguese because it is not too different from Latin. But speaking it, no.
Okay, thank you so much, Brother Kieran. Brother Kieran, now you're living together with Brother Kieran in a community.
That's right.
And yes. Brother Kieran has come many times as a Bible scholar, and you are the missionary who goes out and spreads the word in a different way. Thank you very much, Brother Chris, for having come to the studio. And you are staying in Auckland for a while?
Yes, at least it will be for this year, although really in the last 20 years I've been spending 4 years in one country, then moving on to the next and the next and the next. So I'm still thinking about finding some warmth. New Zealand is a bit cold for me now, despite being brought up in Bluff.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And what is coming up in our Mercy Spirituality Centre? On Saturday, the 18th of May, from 9:30 to 3:30, Sister Catherine Wiles Pickard will facilitate an introductory workshop to Christian meditation. On Friday, the 24th, and Saturday, the 25th of May, Sister Kathleen Rushton will facilitate a weekend workshop with the title Slavery in the New Testament and Displacement of Peoples Today. We often don't realize that there are about 40 million people who are enslaved worldwide, and 800 here in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Please come and learn more about this topic and reflect with us on how we approach people and the earth. The workshop is on Friday, 24th of May, 7 to 9 p.m., and on Saturday, the 25th of May, from 9:30 to 3:30. On Saturday, the 25th of May, we also have Margaret Bowater at our center. She will facilitate a workshop on resolving nightmares. It will take place from 9:30 to 4 o'clock. And also, please note that the workshops with Father Stuart Seller are cancelled. We are happy that on Wednesday, the 5th of June, Brother Kieran Fenn will come and give a presentation on the Holy Spirit and on Pentecost in our center. For all events at other centre, please register with us per phone at Auckland 09-638-6238 or through our website at www.mercyspiritualitycentre.org.nz. I wish you all a blessed Friday and a good week ahead, and thank you very much, Brother Chris, for having come.
Thank you, Bertie. It's been a pleasure.